A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome once again to the Rulur Tech Podcast. This is episode 2. And I am your host, Dan Cavallari. I'm coming at you from Colorado, where it's actually very London weather right now. And fortunately, I do have a Londoner joining me today. Peter Stewart, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Dan. And actually, while it's been raining today, we had a bit of sun yesterday, and I got out on my bike. And so I feel extremely smug that you, a Colorado native, who usually has got Instagram photos of you on some incredible mountain next to black bears on Flagstaff, looking as happy as you could be, and I'm basically soaked from head to toe in my winter booties, having done like a 15K ride that I've given up on. So yeah, I'm feeling good about myself at the moment. Like for
the tables have turned.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, thank you for sending London's finest weather here. It's been raining for about a week now, which is incredibly unusual here. But that's okay. We could use the water, and I'm happy to take a little break for my legs. You know, this is episode 2, as I mentioned, and last episode we did a debate about whether electronic shifting was the future. And we're going to do another debate today. But for those of you listening, I think it's important to know that the format of this show will change episode to episode. We've got all sorts of cool stuff coming up. We're going to be talking to, you know, product managers at various brands, and we're going to have all sorts of neat things to do. But for today, you know, after Peter and I argued about wireless shifting, we kept on arguing about drivetrains, and there's so much to argue about there. And so, you know, like I said, I'm in my garage right now, and it's raining outside, and it's a good day to sort of contemplate all the bicycles in my garage. And right now I'm looking at a bunch of them, and most of them are 1x, except for my road bike, which is 2x. So today, Peter and I are going to debate about whether 1x is the future or 2x. Peter, what's your take?
Well, I'm going to go against the grain of popular thinking at the moment and say that I think 1x is the best solution across the board, except for super specialist cycling I've never even heard of. Any sort of road cycling I've done or know about, I think 1x is an adequate and actually a better solution. So I'm a 1x fan right here.
Okay. I'm of the mind that Peter is always wrong. So I'm going to go 2x, and I say that for good reason. And but before we dive into that and defend our points, let's talk a little bit about what exactly a 1x and a 2x drivetrain is. A 1x drivetrain means that you have one chainring up front, in addition to your cassette in the back. And then a 2x is, of course, you have two chainrings up front and a derailleur to shift between them. And of course, traditionally, road bikes in particular have had two chainrings up front. And honestly, in the past, we've even had three chainrings up front. And that's changed a lot in the last several years. And that change came about largely as an adoption from other types of cycling, mountain biking in particular. And then mountain biking was 1x for a very long time before it came into things like gravel and cyclocross. And now just in the last, I would say, four or five years, road cyclists have started to look at 1x as a viable option for them. And that only came about because drivetrain manufacturers started to address some of the issues that 1x drivetrains bring, especially on the roadside. And a lot of that means the gear combinations, right? So one of the lovely things about a 2x is that you have a lot of different gear combinations. And that's something that as a road cyclist, you're gonna use all of those gears. 1x definitely solved that that issue by making a larger, wider range cassette. The drawback to that was that the jumps between the cogs became much bigger. And so cadence became a problem for a lot of cyclists. So with all those things that were happening, as drivetrains started to evolve, some people jumped on the one by development and have really enjoyed it. A lot of other road cyclists have stuck with two by specifically because they're more interested in a steady cadence, not those bigger jumps between gears. The two by, you know, there's all sorts of other benefits. So we're at a really neat inflection point here in drivetrain development where both two by and one by seem like very viable options. So today, Peter and I are going to face off, very deadly face off, winner take all, like Mortal Kombat. and Peter, you're contending that one by is the future. And I am saying that two by is going to live on, and not only live on, but also thrive. What say you, Peter?
Well, that's a fair claim about my confidence in one by. I've been a one by fan pretty much since the first time I started riding like a one by road setup. And I think it was my old colleague, Stu Bowers, who's Cycling Weekly, Cyclist Magazine. He converted a giant Defy, as I recall, with a really early kind of SRAM kind of mullet setup where he'd used a kind of rear 10 to 36 and a front 48. And he'd done some enormous challenge, like the kind of, it was something like the Tour de Mont Blanc, you know, one of these 300 kilometer, 5,000, 8,000 meter ascent challenges. And he'd been absolutely fine. And the range had been there and he hadn't had an issue. And sort of after that, I was sort of open to the idea of, is one by effective? Do you need two front chain rings? Do you need a front derailleur? And I think further, so I was already on this train of thought, and then I met Jared Vroomen for the first time in person. And again, Jared Vroomen gets a bit of flack for, I think lots of cycling journalists really get quite captivated with his rhetoric, and he's very convincing, very intelligent engineer. And I think most people who speak to him would be like, this guy is a real visionary when it comes to some of the designs he's done. Some have worked, some haven't. I think a lot of them have actually, but nonetheless. But he put it really well. He was like, the rear derailleur is a really beautiful engineering object. It, like, chain flows neatly through it. It delivers the chain. It shifts in a really complex, like finely honed off over a century of time, the way it acts and the way it changes gear. Whereas the front derailleur is literally just two plates that pushes the chain until it falls off the chain ring, which is just like a really crude engineering process of how the shifting comes about.
And the hammer of the drivetrain.
Exactly. It's literally instrument. Like the old rods of the 1903 derailleur setup, you know, before you had any sort of cable actuation. So for me, I think the one by, you know, when he explained it to me that, I was like, actually, I believe in this. If we can make it happen, if it's a viable alternative to two by, why can't we have a go at this technology? And I think one thing I've noticed throughout this whole debate, and I don't know if the social media comments have changed in the last few years to what they were when we initially started this debate, but initially everyone was always the same, and they'd say, well, where's the range? You know, you're gonna have to, I can't climb a mountain like that, I can't descend. And you're like, there's more range in one by group sets. And I'm always explaining this to people, like, you get a SRAM Eagle group set, a 10 to 50 cassette. There is no road group set that rivals that for overall range. And, you know, I think you mentioned that earlier on, so to your credit, you're aware of that, well aware of that. But if you want the largest range possible, a one by group set with a large, long clutched derailleur is going to be the best way to get a massive amount of range. Now, beyond that, obviously that range often, if you want to not have the gaps, the range might sit slightly tighter than, or be skewed one way, in a way that road group set isn't. But even then, I think even if you have gone to, say, 10 to 36 cassette and you go, say, a 46 front chainring, a lot of the time, again, if you put the gears into Sheldon Brown, or, you know, do the gear calculator and work out what your RPM at 120 on the hardest gear, even like a 4410, is going to result in terms of speed, it's still going to be like 52, 55 kilometers an hour. And so if you're doing a decent cadence, you're spinning at a decent rate, you will still be able to ride in a fast chain gang and even get decent speed downhill under the steam of one by group set with a relatively tight cassette. But nonetheless, I've sort of digressed here, because there's actually a wider point, which is that there's this whole illusion about the amount of gears that you get on a 2x group set. You know, the idea that you've got 22 gears when you don't have 22 gears. You know, like a double chainring setup, you know, 53-39 with a 11 to 26, I believe, only actually has 14 functional different gear steps. And so, you know, when you actually look at the duplicates, like, you know, when you compare the 53-19 to the 39-25, whatever, you know, it ends up being effectively the same gear. So you're not actually getting any benefit from those gear steps. All you're really getting is the benefit of the fact that when you're on the front large chainring, you're having smaller steps, relatively speaking. But even then, I think those steps, again, to take it to another level, are a lot less relevant at the high end of the cassette as well. So you can have a bigger spacing at the high end of the cassette, as, you know, 3T did experiment with that with the Strada, about having cassettes that were quite tight in the small cogs, you know, when you're going to have to be really finding that cadence to keep up the group. And then as you get to the large cogs, you're like, well, you're just hanging on. You're just trying to go uphill, kind of whatever cadence you can manage. And so, you know, that was the design I think you can cater for. You don't need to have a consistent gearing step throughout the whole cassette. So, but these are all reasons why I think 2x kind of is slightly over-egged. And beyond that, I think we've just been going for more and more gears for, you know, 12 speed and even 11 speed. I mean, I think like we kind of had things worked out with 9 speed. You know, it was actually a nice group set. And the maintenance for these group sets, it's got to be said. I mean, I don't know if this is an old wives' tale, but I've heard this from Mike Burrows and many other old engineers, that you just did not need to clean your chain or clean your cassette nearly as often with old school kind of 9 speed, 8 speed group sets, because, you know, you just didn't have those tight components, those thin chains. You just wouldn't get the same ingress in like packed dirt and grease. So the question is really, what is the benefit of these more gears? And I think personally, and again, I'm actually, usually I'd say the opposite thing, that the consumer's right. And when consumers say, I like disc brakes, they're saying it because it's true. But I think with gears, they're actually wrong. when they say, I want 24 gears or 22 gears, it's just a really simple quantitative step because of what they see on the shop floor. And again, it's like me when I was like a 10-year-old boy and I was looking at like 27 speed bike, blew my mind. I have no idea why. Literally no reason whatsoever. I don't think I ever shifted off the middle chain ring. You know, it's just like I didn't know how. No one had taught me. So it's just this weird thing that you're like, you know, 27 gears is better than 18 or what have you. So so I think, yeah, you know, in this point I was saying, oh, we used to have triples. If people are really obsessed with steps, go back to triples, go and get your triple chainring, and then you can have all the fun you want with a triple. Sure. But so I think the overall benefits of 1x, again, I think you've got, you know, the a lot of like clutched long cage derailleurs that give you a lot of range, that don't have chain skips. So when you've got the multi-terrain riding, it's better. I think it looks nicer. You have less weight. You have one less maintenance consideration, which is the front derailleur, which I don't know about you, but I always, like, I don't think it's that common to get a bike for test and not to have some sort of rubbing at some point of the front derailleur and the chain. Because I just think, you try and try and try, and it's just like, you're like, ah, God. You know, obviously, if it's your own bike, you have it for years, but obviously, as a bike tester for a decade, like, I'm always getting these new bikes, and I know I probably should get it in a stand and spend like 2 hours like getting it absolutely fine, but usually I just go out on it, and I'm like, yeah, sweet, bike. and then I'm like, oh, it's rubbing, this is so annoying. And if you just remove that acceleration altogether, you know, it's 1x. It's a simple, no rub, no maintenance no fuss solution. And you're not going to pack dirt there. You're not going to have to worry about a whole more bunch of internal cabling. You can just have a blank for where the usual front shifting cable would be. And so for me, I just think the whole thing is just simpler. And, you know, ultimately, when we get to the point we have like 13 speed group sets, like the Eckart or the Rotor, I think there's a lot of gearing, and like in terms of range and in terms of steps on offer. And I think the real only limit, and the reason I think it hasn't taken off, is probably because for professional riders, a lot of time this isn't a very good solution, because they have to be going at such a specifically competitive pace at all points of their cycling. Like when they're climbing like a 15% climb, they're still going at the absolute threshold, and they're still trying to get like an extra, you know, half a kilometer an hour. And when they're going downhill at like a stormy 94 kilometers an hour, they probably still would like to get a little bit of cadence and try and get a bit more speed. But you or I, or even really good cyclists, don't often have to, you know, actually exert themselves at those levels, because usually on 15-20% climb, I mean, even really good riders aren't usually going absolutely, they're just trying to get up it. They're like, if I can maintain a cadence, because, you know, like Mortirolo, do you know anyone that can keep cadence on like that kind of climb? I've never met. You know, like, you see Contador and he's like, oh, you know, he's at 80. You're like, no, there's no group set I've ever seen that can allow you to do 90 RPM without just looking like some ridiculous right. mountain biker on a, you know, climbing at like 2 kilometers an hour. But so yeah. I think, you know, it's just a different, you know, you just kind of manage, I think, a lot of time on a road bike mm-hmm. as a normal cyclist, and you hit the cadence mm-hmm. you can ride at. And that's absolutely fine. I think one by basically means that at those outer extremes, you won't get the exact ideal cadence solution, but most of the time you'll get the overall range that you desire. So you'll be getting enough gearing to get up the mountain, or enough gearing to, you know, pedal out on a descent, and then you're in a tuck or whatever. Not a super tuck, because that's banned, but a normal tuck. And so, yeah, that's overall. Yeah, for now. Yeah, well, that's the next thing, obviously. Once the one bike comes in, we'll be reintroducing the super tuck. But, yeah, and I think this whole thing, you know, really, it probably was killed dead in the water as a result of the Aqua Blue kind of experiment with the 3T Strada. Sure. And I think that was a shame, actually, because I think that was a really cool bike. And I think it was fair for those guys to say they didn't like it. And to be fair, actually, Gerard Bruma, I'd spoken to him in the early stages when he was considering that. And he said he viewed pro teams as an experimental testbed. And that's where he saw the benefit. And to be fair to him, he said that. He's like, you know, we're going to experiment with Team Aqua Blue. And they said they didn't like it. And that was actually an experiment that works. Ultimately, you're like, well, you experimented, the team said they didn't like it. They said some kind of mean things about 3T, which I don't think was entirely fair, but they can say what they want. But I think lots of consumers really love that bike as well, to be honest. I think a lot of people I see around the 3T Strada loved it, and the 3T Strada Due, again, they're both really great bikes. So it was interesting, and I think that whole thing of it going into the Pro Peloton and being rejected really killed it for a lot of road cyclists. But I think we'll maybe see at some point a resurgence. And I think when I was at the World Championships in 2019 in Harrogate, I think Bokan Mollema was riding a one by group set. Which I got excited about and wrote an article about, and then obviously he didn't even finish the race. So, but he was riding a one by after the Aqua Blue experiment, right, and he was managing that. He was excited about riding a one by SRAM ETAP group set, and it was still a pretty hilly course. So he thought he could maintain a ride. He thought he could, you know, stay up with the pack and ride at a world class level with a one by group set, which I thought was interesting. Right. But as many people pointed out to me, he didn't finish, so it didn't work out for him. Right. So there we go. But anyway, so I suppose I'm sort of just rattling on here. I could go on for a while longer, but I think I have to give the floor to you to make a counter-argument, because otherwise I'm just going to talk about the history of derailleurs and what have you.
Yeah, well, you know, we could make this podcast a reference for people, and they can just keep coming back to listen to Peter talk about the past, like the derailleurs. Well, I, you know, those are all very compelling arguments. You're absolutely 100% wrong, and I intend to prove it. But first, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, it is my turn to tell you why I think that Tubai is going to remain the king supreme of the road world for the time being, and for the long haul, to be quite honest. But first, take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Why, hello there. Podcast interruption alert, but I will only take a few short moments to say that if you're enjoying this podcast, you will love the regular magazine. So if you're not a reader already, then you can subscribe at ruler.cc for as little as £6 per month. If you don't speak Northern Irish, that's 6 times 100 pennies. And for the price of a few coffees, you get regular columns from the wonderful Ned Bolting, myself, Orla Shinawee, and some of the very finest independent cycling journalism there is, all wrapped up in a wondrously beautiful publication. Go to ruler.cc. I'll leave you to it.
So my name is Oren Peleg, and I'm an investor in Lekker. Three things that really caught my eye. The first one is they're looking to change the insurance industry, which is a very large industry and I think needs change. The second thing is I'm deeply passionate about getting people onto wheel. We need to address our congestion and pollution crisis, and I believe that two wheels have a massive role to play in that. And the third thing is I can see a growing trend around companies building on the strong communities that they have. And I think Lekker's business model in the way they tap into the community of cyclists is something that's very much on trend at the moment.
Welcome back, friends. We are still debating one buy versus two buy. And, you know, Peter, one thing that I found interesting is that, you know, you focused pretty exclusively on road riding, and I think that makes sense. This is the Rouleur podcast, after all. I'm looking around my garage right now where I am recording my end of this podcast, and I've got a road bike, and that is set up with two by. I've got a gravel bike that is set up with one by. I've got a mountain bike that is set up with one by, and I've got a gravel e-bike set up with one by. So, and I've got a motorcycle that doesn't run. I've got the wide gamut here. So, you know, it's interesting to me to be arguing two by when the vast majority of the bikes that I own are one by. And there's a reason I think that two by is going to last for the long haul in the road world specifically. Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, first, I think the way people ride road bikes is fundamentally different than any other discipline. And I think what most road riders want is control. And so for me, I'm here in Colorado, and between my house and the nearest mountain is about, I don't know, 40 minutes of pretty flat rolling, terrain. I don't need the two by there. But as soon as I get to Golden, Colorado, it starts kicking upward. I need every single gear I have. I need every single combination I have. And like you said, with a one by, I probably have the range I would need. However, I'm really weird about my cadence. There's not much for me to brag about in terms of how I ride a bicycle, but I will say this, I've been complimented on my ability to keep a constant cadence. And for me, that's very important. Cadence is very important for me to not only ensure that I'm getting whatever watts I need to get up a hill or whatever, but for me mentally, it keeps me honed in on what kind of efforts I need to put in for the varying terrain. And so I like to keep a very steady cadence. And what I've noticed, and like you, I've tested a gazillion bikes. I'm always on a different bike. One by, two by, I've done it all. What I've noticed is that with a two by setup, I'm always able to keep a better, more consistent cadence. And despite improvements with the wide range cassettes, there are still fairly sizable jumps between gears that can really affect your cadence. So, you know, if you think about the different styles of riders, there's definitely the tempo riders, the cadence riders, and then there's just the gear mashers, there's the climbers, there's a gazillion different types of riders. And I think the two by drivetrain from a commercial standpoint, as somebody, you know, as a brand trying to sell a bicycle, the two by is going to be the solve for more types of riders. And that's especially true at the world tour level and anywhere in the pro ranks, really, where you've got a wide variety of riders who have a wide variety of requirements, and the two by system is going to accommodate more of them. And now, of course, at that level, you know, the bulky molemos of the world, if he gets to a flat country and he wants to ride a one by, he can do that. And you know, if he's going to be in the mountains, throw on that two by. That versatility is exclusive, almost exclusive to the top echelon of riders. For the rest of us, most people who buy a bike buy one bike. They don't buy 10 like we do, like, because we're crazy. And so there has to be sort of a one solution that works for the vast majority of people. And I think two by is that. And you mentioned, the idea that, you've got 11 speeds in the back and two up front. That's not necessarily 22 speeds. And that's absolutely right. But at any given point, maybe you have four gears, you're in the small chain ring. You got four gears out back where you're feasibly going to spend most of your time when you're in the small chain ring. Those four gears are ideally suited to that situation, to climbing or whatever it is that you're doing. When you shift into the big ring, then you're, on the other side of the cassette, and you've got those whatever six, seven, eight cogs that are useful in those situations. And I think it's that sort of refinement that makes the two by more appealing. Now, you said some really mean things about the front derailleur. I'm gonna defend our dear front derailleur. And I'll be clear here. I think the front derailleur will live on almost specifically, exclusively when it comes to road. It is a blunt instrument, sure, but it is one well suited to road riding. Whereas, gravel riding, for example. You want the simplicity. You don't want a front derailleur to die on you in the middle of Kansas, you know. And frankly, you don't need those options, right? Because the courses in that sense are going to be different than they are going to be for a road course, you know. Road riding, you're up, you're down, you're on the flats. Gravel, you're mostly flat, and then you'll get some short kick-ups. And that's sort of the same thing with mountain biking, right? Like, you can have those long grinded out climbs, but more often than not, you're going to have those sort of up, down, you know, really sharp, really quick. And in those cases, eliminating the complication of a road or a front derailleur makes a lot of sense. On the roadside, however, there's long stretches of time where you might be going as hard as possible. There's long stretches of time where you're going to be, you know, surviving, as you said. And again, I think when it comes to riders who are at sort of a higher level of riding, not just, you know, the newbies who smash the gears into whatever gear they need very indelicately, road racers are more particular, right? You want the option to have the right cadence, the right gear, at all times. And I think the 2x offers that more concisely than a 1x system does. You're not compromising anything for the sake of simplicity. I would also say that, you know, the weight argument, I'm just not sold. I think, you know, I'd have to look back and see what the differences are in some of these group sets, but I think the difference between a 1x group set and a 2x group set in a lot of situations is pretty negligible. We're talking about 250 grams. Let's compare that to something. A full water bottle probably weighs about 600 grams.
Yeah, but if a frame was going from 750 grams to 500 grams, that'd be mind-blowing. Everyone would say, this is the greatest frame ever made. It's changed the cycling industry. 250 grams, it can be significant in frame design or bike design, just putting that out there. I know in the broad philosophical sense, 250 grams is completely irrelevant. It's like, yeah, as you say, not filling a water bottle up or not.
But also the function of a frame between a whatever gram frame and then 200 grams less of that frame, the function is going to be largely the same. Whereas with a drivetrain, you're not even adding 200 grams. You were at 200 grams extra. Now you're debating whether to take 200 grams away by going 1x. But you're also, when you make that debate, you're also debating taking away a pretty significant function of the bicycle, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's not the same debate, I guess, is what I'm saying. With frames, the goal is to make it as light as possible, but the actual function of a frame isn't going to change. With a drivetrain, when you take that weight away, you're taking a function away. And so you need to decide whether that function is worth 200 grams. You know, and to me it is. I think just the ability to tailor my cadence as much as possible and always have the right gear. Let me give you two examples. One, this is a fun one because Peter, you were there. A few years ago, we were in France and we were climbing Alpe d'Huez.
Yeah,
my legs still hurt from it. That was like 5 years ago. And, you know, the whole goal with Alpe d'Huez, right, for us mere mortals is beat an hour. You got to beat an hour. And so, I went deep. And every time I looked back, Peter was on my wheel. And, you know, we keep on going, Peter being on my wheel. It was an hour of Peter on my wheel. And then in like the last like 2 minutes, Peter zipped around me and beat me up the climb. And frankly, I remember, you know, Alpe d'Huez is not super steep, but it does go on for quite a while and there's some kickups, right? And so for me, the ability to sit in for that long period of time, 59 minutes of climbing or whatever it was, and to be able to tailor my cadence was very, very important. It's the reason I survived that climb. And it's probably the reason I also couldn't, you know, stay ahead of you right at the top, but story for a different time. But to me, that's very important. And that's essentially what got me to the top of that climb. Do you think, Peter, at my cadence that I was at on my 2x, had you been on a 1x at that point, could you have matched my cadence comfortably enough to stay on my wheel for that whole period of time? And then, you know, like any racer would, kick up at the top and overtake me.
Yeah. I guess at that point you'd have to look at the kind of, yeah, that 3T idea, whether you'd have like a tapered cassette where it has slightly smaller gaps. But you're right, if it was like 10 to 50, the steps would be considerable. And at that point, I am absolutely a threshold doing like my super efficient 68 RPM design, you know, just totally not a skilled pedaler. Right. But yeah, and also I remember that very differently. It was at least 3 minutes, and then and that's when I jumped ahead of you.
You know, it's all a blur, let's be honest.
Yeah.
I just remember it hurting a lot.
But otherwise, your description of it was completely accurate. Yeah, I was like wheel sucking for an hour.
Yeah.
Dan, slow down. I think I've got a flat tire. Yeah.
Yeah. All I remember is just horrible pain.
Yeah.
That was actually a lot of fun. In any event, I guess my argument is that, you know, whereas one buy seems like an averaging, you know, of elements we need in a drivetrain, the two by, while maybe perhaps indelicate with the front derailleur, offers the whole package, the whole range of things that the drivetrain can be capable of. And I think that may not matter for other disciplines like gravel and mountain, but I think it matters a lot for road riding. So to me, that's the biggest indication to me that two by is not going anywhere. I think we'll see more one by in certain situations. I think, like I said, I mean, the Balki Molimos of the world are going to definitely swap between one by and two by when it suits them. When that course suits a one by, they're going to ride it. When it suits a two by, they're going to ride it because the weight matters to them more. And, you know, the simplicity matters to them more. All of it matters to them more. For everyday Joes, and even like the exceptional everyday Joes, you know, who can slightly beat me up out to us, just slightly, just like at the last second. You know, I think that two by still serves them very well. I just think that as an option for riders who may focus on cadence or just having the right gear at the right time. You know, the other example I wanted to give you was not too long ago, I attempted to ride 14,000 feet up the same climb, just up, down, up, down. It's like a half Everesting. Because I'm half in shape. And, you know, by hour four or whatever it was, I was riding SRAM's ETAP Axis. That's 2x12. And their big shtick is that the jumps between gears in the rear in the cassette are very small so that you can maintain that cassette, that cadence. That was never more important than it was that day. When you get to 10,000 feet of climbing and you're tired and you're trying to just get up the damn climb, you know, like a jump from, you know, between gears from, you know, say a 14 tooth to a whatever 16 or 17 or whatever, that would be huge at that point. Your legs, you know, might not be able to handle it. And you're going to find yourself going back and forth between those gears to find that perfect cadence. Whereas with the ETAP axis system, they've eliminated as many of those large jumps as possible. So you get one tooth jumps between. And that was such a savior for me to slightly micro adjust, essentially. So I think there's just so many situations like that where two by is just so advantageous.
Can I say, I'd like to pause here for a second, because for our British or European listeners, the idea of being 14,000 feet on one climb sounds really impressive, but in Colorado, that's just like 1.5% of Mount Evans or Pikes Peak. In the UK, we'd be doing like the same climb like 80 times, but you just probably went up like one time and then came back to do the last 400 meters.
No, and I'll tell you this though, I did do Mount Evans shortly a few weeks before that, and I was equally unimpressive on that climb. but this one was an up and down, up and down, up and down, and it was only an average. I think it was only an average of 6%. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a super steep climb. There were some kickups, but it wasn't a super steep climb. But the idea was to get 14,000 feet of climbing that day. And so, you know, yes, it is a little different here in Colorado where, you know, everything is up, you know, and up for a very long time. And that's a good example. I mean, Mount Evans, I've climbed Mount Evans once and I pray I never have to do it again. It was very painful, and it's three and a half hours of climbing without let up. At that point, you'll want every edge you can get, you know, and maintaining your cadence is going to be very important in situations like that.
That's one time that I couldn't actually get enough gearing even on like a two by, because it wasn't Mount Evans but Pikes Peak, that's maybe 10 feet lower at its height, but up there, because you've got the lack of oxygen, you're really struggling, and actually getting over the top of the gear, getting some cadence is super difficult. And there I mean, they're kind of, that would have been like a one by would have been okay. So I'm just trying to get up it. But then your example about the way where you are on the threshold trying to keep up with somebody, that is a fair point, that they're, those high-end tight gears are actually really quite valuable.
So you're admitting that. So that's an interesting point. Debate. Yeah.
No, well, I think there's a couple of interesting caveats here that I think...
Okay.
So I think firstly that it's interesting that in this debate we talk about high-end road cyclists, but we don't see entry-level road bikes or even, you know, mid-level road bikes coming with one by when actually it might suit the rider a lot more. Mm-hmm. If this is your first road bike that you're getting coming into being a road cyclist from being a commuter, mm-hmm. you'd think one by would be absolutely sufficient for your needs if you're not going to be, because most, you know, most British riders aren't likely to be climbing out the way immediately, and they certainly won't do it at the pace we did it, you know, the mighty pace of, you know, seasoned tech journalists. But, you know, I think that there probably wouldn't, there'll probably be a few years before you get to the level of cycling where you're likely to be really able to put a concerted threshold effort on a climb like that. Mm-hmm. So I find it weird that you don't get just, you know, the normal beginner bike being a one by. It doesn't necessarily strike me as making sense that those benefits you're talking about are quite a high level kind of, either it's the benefit you see from being a very high level athlete or as a very experienced athlete that knows your optimum physiology and your optimum performance at certain cadences. Right, so that's an interesting one. And then the other caveat, again, the trick up my sleeve that I didn't mention earlier on, but there's this kind of whole new development of internal hub gear shifting with the classified hub. Have you seen this classified hub? So
I know of it.
Yeah. So I've never seen it in the flesh. I don't even really know how it works. But essentially what it's offering is a ratio switch within the hub mm-hmm. that then the cassette will move at a different pace to the hub itself.
Right.
And so that, I think, as a future development technology, it's super interesting because, I mean, and to be fair, it is actually two by, you might claim, and that would be true. But what you're offering there is greater range without using the front derailleur and this clumsy front derailleur setup that's mm-hmm. restrictive in terms of, you know. Sure.
I mean, if they could pull that off, if they could pull that off and not add a ton of weight, which has always been sort of the problem with those types of hubs, that could certainly be a pretty big leap forward. Yeah, absolutely. But as it is, I mean, you know, how many years off is that, you know, and how many refinements are we going to have to go through before, you know, that becomes a viable product, you know?
That's very accurate that those technologies we see come along, a lot of time they seem so finished and so perfect, and yet sometimes just never appear. Like, I know the Brim Brothers power meter, I don't know, the shoes that had power meters within them, those appeared literally about 10 years ago, and it seemed like, oh, this will be the future power meters for, and never saw a working sample. You know, even you saw them, you know, some magazines had them and things, but a lot of the time it just doesn't quite hit the point to be saleable for the mass market. So it might be the case here, but that said, I know very little about the company. I've not seen a live sample. I'd like to. I think I'd be really interested to test it out and see what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one final point I think should be made before we wrap up here is that, you know, when we talk about all these technologies that are getting poured into bicycles and, you know, we see all these astronomical prices and things like that, I think you need to realize that, you know, with developments in bicycles, it's actually always more complicated than in most other vehicles. You know, the most common one that people compare it to is the motorcycle. Well, you know, I could buy a motorcycle for that price. Yes. But the point with motorcycles is that the engine is an engine. On the bicycle, the engine is you. And so with a motorcycle, you know, if something's heavier, you just add more horsepower, you know, and that's the fix. With a bicycle, you can't do that. There's so many parameters that need to be met. It needs to be usable. It needs to be smooth. It needs to be fast. It needs to be efficient. It needs to be light. You know, those are all things that are very difficult to meet, you know? And so for whatever reason, you know, that shoe, for example, the power meter shoe, there was something that did not, some parameter that did not get met to make it feasible for cyclists. And I think there are many things you can do with a drivetrain to make it more efficient, to make it, you know, whatever, faster, wider gear ranges. But does it meet all the other parameters, the efficiency, the lightweight, you know, the usability, the tunability, all that other stuff? That's what makes these so difficult. And that's why I think the drivetrain largely hasn't changed dramatically in hundreds of years. I mean, it's still chain driven, it's still gears, you know, now Ceramic Speed has something really cool coming out or that has been out for a while. And they're trying to make that viable. But again, you know, is it viable for the cyclist? And that's always the big question. For now, I still think 2x is that answer. 1x is definitely nipping at its heels, and I think we're going to see more of it.
It's an interesting point. I just had to say actually about the engine as well, because you're right that the engine becomes this factor that in terms of gear ratio, because the human body is quite limited in terms of what it can achieve and what
especially mine
torque and what its watts can do. But no, that's not fair, Dan. You know, you nearly kept up with me and out the way, and that's something a lot of people are pretty proud of themselves for.
I heard that nearly. I heard the nearly part of that qualification.
Yeah, that was the time my front brake was on the whole climb as well. It was such a burden.
Oh, how about that? Yeah.
So but I think the interesting point is here, you know, the E-road setup, and I don't know, E-road's one of these things, I don't know the slower takeoff either, and I don't want to get into this conversation about E-roads, but E-road, a lot of those solutions, like the Specialized S-Works Creo, it's got a 1x setup because you do have that solution at the really steep climbs that you have the extra wattage from the battery coming in, and you have that help to get that cadence at a really slow, really high incline and potentially quite slow speed. So that's interesting. That slight addition of technology bringing in a bit of electronic power to the bike is actually maybe removing the necessity for that front derailleur. And as you say, that's partly the same as motorcycle because you remove that design constraint that is the human body. But again, e-road bikes, that's a debate for a different day because we're opening a whole can of worms there.
Many, many cans of worms, I'm sure. Well, we want to hear from you guys who are listening. And you tell us who won this debate. Is 2x the future or is 1x? Is it a Colorado win or is it a London win today? Who's taking home the crown? You can reach out to us. Peter, how can the folks reach you and Ruleur?
Well, we'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Ruleur Magazine Instagram, at Ruleur on Twitter, Ruleur Facebook page. Read our content at ruleur.cc or email us directly at info@ruleur.cc.
And if you'd like to contact me directly, I'm on the social medias at Brown Tie Dan. That's on Twitter and Instagram. I would be absolutely thrilled to hear from you all for you to heap praise on me and tell me how much I won this debate and tell me that Peter cheated and beat me up Alpe d'Huez that one time. Feel free to flatter me as much as possible. Peter, thanks for debating today. That was fun.
Thanks so much, Dan. Always a pleasure to be here.
All right. And this has been episode 2 of the Ruleur Tech Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover in the future, please do reach out and let us know. In the meantime, this is Dan Cavallari signing off till next time. And Peter Stewart, thank you again. And we will catch you on the next episode. If you are new to the wonderful world of Ruleur, welcome aboard. It's great to have you. We call it the finest cycling magazine in the world, and with good reason. Quality photography, writing, and design are at the heart of every issue, bringing cycling culture to cultured cyclists. Subscribe now to receive our upcoming Tour de France special at ruleur.cc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.